We'll be reading first this morning from Hebrews chapter 11, verses 29 to 31. And I just want to say, as I was praying over these verses this week, I was just blessed and struck with how privileged we are to attend a church that always has and prayerfully will continue to teach truth from the Word of God and not the opinions of men. And that really is a blessing. Like me, maybe you've been places where that isn't the case. And so I'd encourage you to continue to pray for Gary as he teaches us from the Word, for our staff, and for all the teachers, from the little children all the way to the adults, that we would continue to be a people to be taught under the Word of God. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 29 to 31. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given friendly welcome to the spies. And now Joshua chapter 6, verses 22 through 25. And Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house and bring out from it the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her." So the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought all her kindred and set them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and all within it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and of iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. But Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she dwelt in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho.
Paige and I, before we were married, were sitting under the arch one day having a picnic, not the golden arches, but the arch of St. Louis. And neither of us had been there before, or, as you'll find out, had read much about it before this moment. We were sitting there and, you know, the gateway arch, of course, the gateway to the west. And before we were married, we were, you ever have these, I know you do, and each of us could stand up and talk about these aha moments, these wake up moments. And you know, we just woke up there and said, one day we're going to be in Portland out on the west. No, we didn't say that, But as we were having lunch there, this little picnic, we started seeing people walk down underneath the arch. And at that moment, we didn't know that you could do that. And so we're wondering, where are they going? And so our curiosity, of course, got the best of us, so we followed. And there's, as most of you know, another world down there. And there's a museum and movies, and then all these people are standing in line and they're getting tickets. And so we stand in line and say, what are we getting tickets for? And there was the tram to go up to the top. And of course, the Arch of St. Louis is over twice the size of the Statue of Liberty. And so this huge monument, of course. And so we go up in the tram, and I could tell you stories about Paige losing her purse in the tram and all of what that went, what happened with that. But the point of even why I tell you that, it was one of those just wake-up moments for us, aha moments, a wake-up call to say, we had no idea that it was this great, the grandeur of this monument. Now, many of us, we believe God. We believe Jesus, we believe the right doctrine, and we believe truth. But for many, if not always for us, we need those aha moments where God gives us those wake-up calls to where it's not just something that you're believing some precise information or correct doctrine, but God's showing us, this is who I am, and this is your identity in me. Rahab, of whom Rick read just a moment ago from Hebrews 11, and if you want to keep your finger there, we're going to be in Joshua 2 and Hebrews 11 most of the time this morning, because that's where her story starts, I believe is one of those wake-up calls. is why she's even in this chapter in the first place. Because this is a chapter that the writer of Hebrews has listed all these men and women of faith in order to say to the original readers, look at these people. Don't, those of you who say you name the name of Christ, don't chuck it. Keep on keeping on. And let me give you some examples of some people who are faithful, some people who have walked in faith. And that's what is happening here in Hebrews chapter 11. Now, why her a wake-up call? Because as you're listening to Rick read a moment ago, by faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. Okay, we heard about that. Moses had led the people out of Egypt, and they had crossed the Red Sea, but the Egyptians, they couldn't make it. And by faith, the walls of Jericho fell. Yeah, we know about that story. Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. And after the people had marched around them for 7 days, and then by faith, Joshua led the people into the promised land. But Joshua's not there. Wait, Moses made it. Abraham made it. What about Joshua? He's the one that had the baton passed to him to send them in. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, where we'd have thought Joshua would have been. But then it's maybe a bit of a curveball here. Maybe a bit of a wake up. Wake up. Because by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. You see, she was the one that the writer puts in here to show us how without faith, it's impossible to please God. She's the one that the writer puts in here to say, look at her life. Look at how she lived. Look at what God was doing in and through her. Wake up. Wake up. And as we see this, we're going to see how Israel, I believe, first received this wake-up call way back when, during Rahab's time. Not only was Rahab awakened to the greatness, the might, the majesty, the mercy of God, if you will, but the Israelites were. And the first readers of Hebrews, this chapter 11, it had to be a wake-up for them. And my prayer for us this morning is, God, you'd wake us up just the same, that we would see the greatness, that we would see the very mercy of God. Now, the way I'd like us to approach this story this morning is just actually the way I approached it last week of just bombarding it with questions. Not a bad way as you're reading the Bible anyway, just to start asking questions. And the first question, as we read this, by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who are disobedient, why is a harlot considered faithful for harboring spies? Why is a harlot considered faithful for harboring spies? And then to answer this question, we would have to ask, well, why did she hide spies in the first place? What was she doing? What was going on here? Well, actually, the answer to that question is really, really simple. Why is a harlot considered faithful for harboring spies, and why did she hide them anyway? Rahab was in this city of Jericho, and she had heard just what we just read about, of how the Red Sea had parted, of how God's people had gone across there and the Egyptians had drowned. And she'd heard about all these other kind of things that God was doing. She heard about that. But not only did she hear, she believed what she heard. I mean, you could hear a lot of things and never believe it, but she believed it. And then she didn't just hear it, and she didn't just believe that it was right information that she had heard. She acted on it. She committed herself to this God. Now, as I explain that, it's really the journey of faith for anybody, isn't it? I mean, anybody and everyone, obviously not like Rahab in the way that she went about her journey of faith, but anybody who comes to faith in God through His Son Jesus has this same foundational journey. Look in Joshua 2, and I want to show you what I'm talking about very quickly here of why she's considered faithful for harboring these spies. Verse 8 of Joshua 2. Now, before the spies lay down for the night, so they're picking up, and we'll go back in a moment and pick up other parts of the story, but they're already in her house. They're getting ready to lay down for the night. She goes up on the roof where they're hiding, and she says to them, "I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We've heard about this." Matter of fact, she goes on to say that, verse 10, "We have heard. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea." We heard this. Not just Rahab, but her family and everybody in Jericho and everybody through the land. I mean, news like that, you think it's going to travel, right? A whole sea dried up for a season? I mean, they hear about it, of course. But they believed it. "For when you came out of Egypt and what you did to Sihon and Og, we heard about this, the two kings of the Amorites, east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed." Verse 11, "We heard about all this. And our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you." Not only did we hear about it, it impacted us, and it did something to us. "For the Lord your God is God in heaven, is God in heaven above and on the earth below." So she's not just hearing about it. She's not just believing the stuff that happened. She's believing there's no other God. This is the one true God. And so she hears that and she believes this is the one true God. What is the next logical step? She acts on it. "Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I've shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death." The reality of knowing there is a God goes all the way in her mind, in her life, in her actions, in her commitment to saying, it's not just a reality, but He's a refuge. I need to know this God. I need to know that He's going to protect me. I heard about it. I believe it. Now, please make sure that He protects me, that you protect me, and make sure there's a sign that this will happen because I need to be protected. It's exactly what the writer of Hebrews is saying in chapter 11. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Impossible for her to be rescued unless she pleases God through faith. How does this, what does this look like? Well, he says in verse 6 of chapter 11 that you must believe first, obviously, that He exists, that He is, and then that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. And this is exactly what Rahab is doing. She hears, she believes, and she also acts on that and seeks after Him and believes in His mercy. God will give me this refuge if I seek Him. You see, genuine faith never rests content with being convinced of the reality of God, but presses on to take refuge in God. It's not about just correct information and precise doctrine, although that's important. But Rahab cried out due to her understanding of her desperate need for God. It's more than hear. It's acting. It's following. It's running to Him. It's seeking Him for refuge. This is the one, he says, is the faithful who pleases God. I think the greatest question, though, as we look at this story, as we're asking some questions, and really as you read any account in Scripture, is what is God doing? What is God doing here? I mean, if God gave us His Word, if God is the primary character of His Word, if He's the primary one who's seeking, then what's He doing? What is God about? Hebrews, back to Hebrews 11. By faith, the people had passed through the Red Sea. Now by faith, verse 30, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days. But the walls of Jericho didn't completely fall. Pastor, it says the walls of Jericho fell. I thought you said we believe the Bible. We do believe the Bible. But not every part of the wall fell, because the Bible lets us know that not every part fell. You see, there was one part that had this red rope hanging out of it, because there was a house built into or onto the wall that housed Rahab, this harlot. And where this red rope was, this scarlet cord was, It didn't fall. It wasn't destroyed. Because she and her family were in there. Because they believed God and they acted on it. Now, some modern scholars, some current scholars today are saying that the red rope was a sign. People putting a red rope out was a sign that it was a house of prostitution. I don't know if that's true or not. That's what some are saying. It would sound reasonable. The Red Rope District is where they would go for that sort of thing. But she didn't have the red rope out finally just because of her profession, whether that's what it meant or not. The red rope, the scarlet cord, was out. Well, it was because of her profession, but not her vocation, but her profession that God is who He says He is. That God is going to fulfill His promises, and that she was making a confession to Him to come under His allegiance even. As we look at the next verse, by faith the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. The spies had asked her, here's the sign, you put the scarlet cord out and you'll be saved. Not just you, but anybody and everybody who's in that home with you will be. What's God doing here? Let me zoom out a little bit as we look at the big picture of the story. We could go back all the way to Genesis, and Abraham is given this promise. Given a promise that he will have all these descendants, as many as the sands on the seashore and the stars in the sky. And these descendants are promised this land. There's this promised land that they've been given by God. Now, they had gone into and out of it for years. But now, as we come to our story, over 700 years have gone by. And they still haven't realized this promised land. And they're still waiting for this. And now it's been over 700 years, and Moses, the one we know that's supposed to take them into the promised land, he's about to die. And so here he is with Joshua. There's Moses and there's Joshua. And the Lord tells Joshua at this time, really a very same thing that he had told Moses about 40 years earlier. You see, about 40 years earlier, Moses was supposed to take the people on into the promised land. But he sent in these 12 spies. The people were saying, hey, we're sending these spies. Let's see about it. 10 of them had said, hey, this is great. All 12 said, this is great. Look at the fruit. This is some great land. It's filled with milk and honey. But 10 of them said, oh, but they're giants there. We're like grasshoppers in their eyes. We can't do that. But Joshua and Caleb, only two, said, no, God's given us the land. Let's go in there. And God had told Moses at that time, be strong and be courageous. I've given you the land. It's yours. But he didn't go in. And the people, the Israelites, actually got scared. And they didn't go in. So they wandered around some 40 years. Now Joshua, right on the brink of Moses' death, is told by God, Joshua, you now be strong. You now be very courageous. Because you are the one that are going to lead my people into this land. And he said, not only will you lead my people into this land, but I'll be with you myself. I'm going to go with you. Let me take a time out from the story for a moment. Because you have to realize that as we talk about this story, the land of promise is brought back up again in the book of Hebrews, in the New Testament, several hundred years later. And it's still, in some ways, talking about it like it's still in existence. Chapter 4 of Hebrews, the promise of entering His rest still stands. But it's not about entering this rest of this promised land. What the writer of Hebrews does for us now is to say, Joshua and leading the people into this promised land is a picture. It really happened, it's true. But it's a picture, it's a metaphor for us, if you will. Because Joshua is a picture of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ wants to lead you into ultimate rest, into heaven. But you have to follow, but you have to believe, and you have to act upon your belief. Listen as I read it in chapter 4 of Hebrews. Since the promise of entering His rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the gospel or the good news preached to us, just like they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them. The message that Moses had told them 40 years before this incident with Joshua, they didn't follow. It wasn't of any value to them. That's what Hebrews 3 talks about. Of their hearts were hardened and they didn't believe. They didn't go in. And he's saying, don't let that happen to you. Now, he's not talking about you standing on the bank of Jordan. He's talking about you standing on the bank of hearing the good news of Jesus Christ. Will you believe? Will you follow Him? Will you go with Him? It is now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God said. Back to the story, Moses dies. What does Joshua do when Moses dies? He doesn't immediately run in and take the land, although it's almost immediately. He turns to the officers and he says, go prepare the people. Go prepare the supplies. For in 3 days, we're going to cross over the Jordan here and we're going to go in and we're going to take the land that God has promised us. He's promised this to us. So in 3 days, we're going to do it. Now, that brings another question to my mind as I'm reading it. Why wait another 3 days? I mean, it's been over 700 years. Let's go do the deal. Let's get the land. He said it's ours. Let's go take it. Let's go ahead and go in. Why 3 more days? I believe it's part of the wake-up call. That God has them wait 3 more days because He has a few more things He wants to teach them. He has something else about Himself, about what He's doing, about who He is, that He still wants to point out to them before they go in. So, Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent 2 spies from Shittim, go, look over the land, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab, and they stayed there. So Joshua secretly sends in these 2 spies. Another question. Why secretly? Why did he send them in secretly? Maybe he was thinking back about when he and Caleb went with those other 10. And they went in, and when they came back with this report, all of a sudden nobody wanted to go in anymore because everybody was scared except for he and Caleb. And they were saying, oh, let's go in. Let's do this. God's given us the land. I'll let you can do some homework on it if you want. Deuteronomy or Numbers 13, Deuteronomy 1, if you want to read some of those accounts. But when you read those accounts, you see that very clearly God had given the land, but the people were scared and didn't go in. That's why, take courage. Take courage. Be strong. Be courageous. Go ahead and do it. Or maybe it was just because spies go in secretly. So the spies go in. They go in secretly. Why send the spies? Why do the spies go in the first place? Well, that's a silly question, Gary. Why are the spies going in the first place? They're going in for reconnaissance. They're going in to gather information. They're going in to get the lay of the land. And they're going in to see what the military strategy should be all about. Okay, let's follow that line of reasoning for a moment. So they're going in. They want to see what the blueprint is. And so one of them is Michael Schofield. And they paint this big map on his back. None of you do the prison break thing, do you? And they probably didn't do that, but maybe they had a scroll and they were writing out, here's the map of the land, and here's how to get in, and here's how to get out, and here's put down the measurement of the wall. You got your tape measure, yeah. Okay, the wall is this wide, so if we're going to have a battering ram, this is how big it needs to be, and how tall is it up there? Well, and he writes it down, it's this tall, so if we want to catapult somebody or something over, we'll know. And how many guards? Okay, there are 2 guards here and 3 there. And this is what kind of weapons they have. And okay, we've got all this information. Now let's go back to Joshua and let's make this plan. So they get back to Joshua. And remember, he sent them in secretly. So they sit down in his tent secretly. So what's the plan? Let's make a strategy. All right, we've got it. We gathered the information. Here's what we're going to do. We figured out that these people get real dizzy when they go in circles. We saw somebody walk around somebody and the guy just fell down. He got dizzy. And so why don't we walk around the walls? And we'll walk around it every day. And why don't we do that about 7 days? On the seventh day, let's walk around it 7 times. And they'll get really dizzy then. And you know what else? These people, they don't like noise. They hate noise. I mean, a little bit of noise, and they just go crazy. So on that seventh time, on that seventh day, after we've walked around the city, let's just shout. Let's just shout as loud as we can and watch them go ballistic. How do you like that plan? That's utterly ridiculous, isn't it? So what did they do? They walked around the city. 6 days. One time each day. Seventh day. 7 times. Blew the trumpets. Shouted. And what happened? The walls came tumbling down. And the people just didn't know how to act. But it wasn't because those spies went in and devised this wonderful plan. It was because it was God's plan. Matter of fact, the spies never could have come up with a plan like that. They'd have been sent out quickly if they did come up with a plan like that. So why, let me go back to my question. Maybe my question is more sensible now. Why send in the spies? Because when Moses sent them in years before, it was to find strengths and weaknesses and lay of the land and all that stuff. But Joshua doesn't say anything about that. Nor do the spies report anything about that. What do the spies report? Well, listen to their report. Verse 24 of chapter 2 in Joshua. They said to Joshua, here's the report. The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. Okay, I told you that. God's been telling us that for years and years and years. And all the people are melting in fear because of us. That's the report. Didn't they know all that? Didn't they know all that? Yeah, they knew all that. But they didn't know all that, did they? The point of the spies then was that God is going to make good on His promise. Let me give you one more wake-up call. Let me give you one more point of assurance. Did they need a wake-up call? Did they really need a wake-up call? I mean, they were told. Moses must have told them every day for 40 years. Guys, He's given us the land. He's given us the land. Let's live for Him now and go back and get it. And now Moses is dead and Joshua is saying, guys, let's go. You with me? The Lord told me, be strong and courageous. Let's go. Let's do it. And they even wanted to do it. They wanted to go in and take it. They thought they were strong and courageous. Watch this. Look at verse 16 of chapter 1. They answered Joshua. Joshua saying, we're going in. Whatever You've commanded us, they say, we'll do it. Wherever You send us, we'll go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses. Oops. Don't go there. But we'll obey You. They wanted to. They were ready to. Only may the Lord your God be with you as He was with Moses. Whoever rebels against Your word and does not obey Your words, whatever You command them, will be put to death. Listen to this. Now it's not God telling Joshua this, it's the people. Joshua, be strong, be courageous, we're with you, win or tie. What about lose? No, we're with you. Were they? Yeah, I think they were. But history had shown that they had said a lot of good words before, but they weren't really with Him. They weren't really with God. They weren't really with Moses. As a matter of fact, before Moses died, you can look at the Song of Moses, and he knew, you know what, they're going to rebel again. It's going to happen again and again and again. So what is God doing? So how does God respond to this kind of faith that says, I'm all in. but the knees are a little weak and not sure they're all in. So you just stomp them out. Look at the grace of God. He says, let me have a harlot give you a wake-up call. No, none of these people in Jericho understood my greatness. All they saw it. But let me show you somebody who understood it and believes and is now taking refuge in me. And so he sends the spies in and they get a wake-up call from a harlot. I mean, think about it. Why is Rahab even in this chapter? Why is chapter 2 even here? Chapter 2 of Joshua doesn't have to be in the Bible for it to flow very smoothly. End of chapter 6, chapter 1. Joshua says, we're going in. We're with you, Joshua. Let's go. What happens? Chapter 3. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out and went to the Jordan where they camped before crossing over and they were about to go in. It would flow just perfectly, wouldn't it? We're with you. We're going with you. Okay, we go. But no, wait. No, wait. There's more for you to know. There's a wake-up call to be had here. I asked the staff this past week, our ministry staff, why is Joshua 2 here? Why is Rahab in here? And Judy appropriately says, she said, well, Rahab's in the line of Jesus Christ. And she's pointing us to Jesus, and we see this. And she's exactly right. And here she is, right in the line of Jesus. But still, let's piggyback on that. And why? Why is this important? Why does this help us here? Well, because of who she is even. Who she is in the line of Jesus. Who she is showing us how God welcomes the most unwelcomed. And even his son comes through the line of what we would call the pagan of the pagans. What's the wake-up call? What's the significance about her appearance here? Let me see if I can name a couple of things. One, it's a lesson to learn that God is who He says He is. That God will do what He says He will do. That God is a promise keeper. God is saying, let me pull back the shade here as it were. And let me show you my greatness. Let me show you my mercy. Even in the house of a prostitute. Wake up. And actually, this is God's normal practice of showing His graciousness in these ways. I mean, think about it for a moment. Many of our faces, we see each other week after week after week after week. And then some of you are in small groups together. Some of you are Tuesday night with the college group, or Wednesday with children or teens or men and women, or Thursday with the 20s and 30s meet. And you hear of God's greatness, His mercy, week after week after week after week. And if I asked you, do you believe? Yeah, I believe. So what does it look like in your life? How is God transforming you? How are you living missionally? What does this look like for you? And we realize, oh, I need to wake up. Oh yeah, I say I believe that. I do. God, wake me up. And He's gracious to do that. I mean, here's Anna on the front row to talk about how, I think it was a few years ago, you heard Carrie's story. And it's like, wow, wake up. And so Mary Alice invites her to come speak to the ladies about truth and transformation. I've heard some of you say, I knew this truth. I knew my identity. And all of a sudden you wake up. There are books that you've read that God's been gracious with to wake you up. You've talked about knowing God, but it woke you up at one point. And other books, other things do that. There's, I don't see Steve Atkinson's face here, but Steve Atkinson and Rick Caffell have been passing around some CDs. And I got one of these because God woke them up through it and woke me up through it. And it's a message from a man by the name of Chip Ingram. And Chip Ingram is the leader of Walk Through the Bible. And he tells his story of how when he was a younger pastor and he's at this church and there's this man with very significant means financially. And he comes to Pastor Chip Ingram there and he says, essentially, I have great means and I want to help people. I want to bless people. I want to help those people that are really, really needy. I want to do what Christ has called us to do. And he said, Chip, you have the opportunity because you see these kind of people day in and day out. And so he gave him a checkbook. And if I remember the story, there were $5,000 in the checkbook or in the account. He said, take this checkbook, and anytime you see somebody that's in need, then you just help them out. And the only thing I'd like from you is once a quarter, we'll get together and you just tell me what you did. And we'll celebrate it. And so now Chip has $5,000 that he's the steward of. You think he was looking for people to help? Yeah. And all of a sudden, he finds a need and he writes a check and he helps them and he takes care of them. And his checkbook is not even nearly as good a shape as this new checkbook's in, because he's a steward of this and he's got to use this. And when he goes and he meets with the man in his high-rise office in this plush restaurant and they celebrate what God is doing through this, it's just a beautiful time. And he says, it was a wake-up call. Just like God has given me a life, resources, money and time and talents and whatever the package is, he wants me to be a steward of that. And all of a sudden, it was like, how can I use this? Is that the way it is with your life? God, I'm a steward of all of your resources, the money I have, the talents, everything that I am. How can I bless others through you? How can I proclaim the gospel with all that you've given me of all that I am? It's a wake-up call. If you haven't got no CD, see Steve or Rick. Because he wants us to wake up. Last Sunday morning, most of you were in this service, so you weren't in the first service. Let me give you a peek into the first service. We did communion in the first service like you've been doing communion here for the last, I don't know, year and a half, where you come to the tables and instead of somebody going out to serve you, you come and the server serve you. And if you recall last week, we just had elders and pastors that were just praying for you as well. Well, that's the first time the first service has ever done that. And change is not easy, even if it's good. It's really not easy if it's bad. But even if it's good, change isn't easy. And so we did this in the first service, and we finished, and I'm looking out, and there are all these little white hankies of just people that God is affecting by community, affecting by what Christ has done on the cross through His death and then through His resurrection. And Bob Butler, I don't know if you know him, but he's 81 years old. He was one of the servers last Sunday in that first service. And we had a conversation, and I won't tell you where it was. Too much information, but I was in the restroom in between services. And I'm walking out, and there's Bob. And he wants to address me, and he says something about some unspiritual advice. And I didn't really know what he was talking about at first. I'm thinking, okay, you're coming to me for unspiritual advice. I'm not sure about this, right in between preaching times. But then he went to explain what he meant. He said, no, I want to tell you something that may sound unspiritual. I said, okay. He said, communion, first service, home run. I said, that's not unspiritual. Thank the Lord. And what he meant by that was, God woke me up. And then Bozy Budlong, who's close to the same age, if not older, and I'll have to deal with them later on these statements. But he was serving as well. And he said, Gary, I was affected like I've never been before. And I think he may have even used the term wake-up call. God is gracious. What kind of, think in your life, what kind of wake-up calls has He been giving you? And are you awake? I think one of the most beautiful wake-up calls is this. When you're listening to someone teach or someone preach or somebody even bumble through a passage, and God arrests you with His truth, and He wakes you up. You've had that happen, haven't you? Oh, the graciousness of God. He's saying, come on. Come on. We've got a lesson to learn. He, in His graciousness, He wants to wake us up. Why Rahab? Why Joshua 2? Well, not only a lesson to learn with this wake-up call, but I think the wake-up call is to see that there was a soul to save. There was a soul to save here. In that staff meeting, when I asked, why is Rahab here? Mary Alice said, or I believe I asked why with a spy sent in, and she said, well, Rahab had to be rescued. And the rest of us were like, well, Joshua didn't know she had to be rescued. But God did. But God did, didn't He? There was a soul to save. And they had to wait these 3 days because there was a soul that was still yet to find refuge in God. And God in His graciousness was ready to welcome her. And who is it that He welcomed? The most unwelcome that we can think of. I mean, this is like a picture of Jesus. It is a picture of Jesus, isn't it? Where did the spies find themselves? But in the house of the harlot. Same kind of place where Jesus would have found Himself. Same kind of place that everybody else in church has said, don't go there. You gotta be kidding me. And that's where He was. That's where they were. Not only that's where they were, but as Rick read a moment ago in Joshua 6, it's where the rest of the family came to find refuge in God with her. Come on, Mom and Dad. These people are marching around and these walls are going to fall down. It's going to be disastrous and everybody's going to be destroyed. But if you'll come with me and just follow their God, follow Yahweh. Go into your house? No way. Please. Yet her family, her brothers and sisters and others believed her passion, believed that her following of Christ. And they were saved. Why? Because God's people did as well. The spies did as well. And then in Joshua chapter 6, you see when Joshua came on the scene and found the family, said, bring them on in, save them. And they became just like part of the Israelites. They became part of that community. And they were welcomed in. The very unwelcome. Over Christmas, my family and I, we worshiped at a sister church. And after we left, we were driving back home, and Paige and the children were with me, and I just started asking them about what they had learned that day and what God may be teaching them, and just going over the morning's events of worship as our family. And so I was talking about things, and one of my children said, well, the sermon was boring. And I thought, I'm glad it wasn't me preaching this time. And I said, well, why do you think the sermon was boring? You see, I'm giving you helps to ask, why do you think the sermon was boring? Write that down when your children ask that. And he said, because he was just talking about all that racial stuff. Sorry, Caleb, I gave you away. He said, because he was just talking about all that racial stuff. And at first, I didn't like hearing this about a sermon being boring. But then when I heard why, it was actually refreshing. Why? Because he just didn't really have all those categories of those kinds of what the sermon was being talked about. Because the sermon was about racial reconciliation. And he didn't have those categories of those kind of prejudices that needed to be focused based on exactly what was being taught there. And so I thought, well, that's okay that it was boring then. But then we talked a little bit, and since then I've thought a lot more about, okay, maybe we don't have those racial prejudices. And thank the Lord. And thank the Lord, you know, for giving us His grace and even giving us a weekend like this to celebrate one that He used here in America, Martin Luther King Jr., to help us move away from some of that. But what other kind of prejudices do we have? And I started thinking about me and us at Henson. Who are the unwelcome that we need to welcome. Maybe I'll pause for a moment because you probably have a lot, maybe a different list than I do. And maybe you need to go over that list in your mind for a moment before I say anything. But some I was thinking about were people that maybe don't believe theologically the way I believe the Bible, just like I do. Maybe those that don't have the same economic place that I have. You go on and on. Here's the one that I finally landed on that I wanted to mention for a moment here. Because it's a prejudice that I think is a perceived prejudice. But every prejudice may just be a perceived prejudice, so I probably shouldn't say that. But I think it's a false barrier that we put up. And what I'm saying is, I think it's a generational prejudice that I see here at times. That the older generation, they just don't care about us. Or the younger generation, they don't care about us. They don't care what we've been about and what we've been through. And I see some of that at times. Yet, and I call it a false barrier or a false, I don't think it's real. Because when I talk to you, I hear so many of you saying, "Oh, I'd love to sit down and just learn from people with gray hair. I'd love to hear those people and just hear the stories." But they just don't seem to want to be in our lives. Or I sit down with gray hairs and I pray for them all the time, my children, my grandchildren, and these, and I love them, and I just don't understand them, though. I don't know how to pour into them. Last Friday, a couple of days ago, I'm talking to Dick Wahlstrom. And Dick Wahlstrom sits right about here where Chris and Rachel and Bob are sitting. And in his first service, he's like a short Abraham Lincoln with gray beard, but doesn't have a mustache. And so now you know you can pick him out in the hallway. But I'm talking to him, and I asked about his wife, Doris, because Doris has been battling cancer. So I asked, "How's Doris doing?" And he just perked up. And he said, "You know, she's doing great. He said, they call it remission, but there's no sign of it. There's no sign of the cancer. And where there's some normalcy again in our life." And he talked about all the what that meant. And he looked at me and said, "Gary," he said, "after 52 years of marriage, we're on a honeymoon." 52 years. He said, "We're on our honeymoon." He said, "I love it. I love her." He said, "I found out I'm abandoned to her well-being." Isn't that beautiful? And he went on to say, and Dick has been a counselor. And all of his adult life, he said, "I've been telling people, life is about relationship with God and with people. And I've been trying to help people see that. And it took this going through this cancer," he said, "for God to finally wake me up. And I believe what I've been saying for all these years." So I said, "Dick, what do you tell a guy who hasn't lived 52 years, much less been married 52 years, so that I don't have to wait for something like that for a wake-up call? How do you help me? How do you help me to have that wake-up call now to give that kind of love to my wife?" And he kept talking about how it was the Holy Spirit that had been leading him through this process, and how can I listen to the Spirit like that? And he just shared life with me for a while. Take some of those chances, my friends. Find somebody with gray hair and just ask them, "How do you know God is great? How do you know about His mercy? How did you make it 52 years in a marriage? How? I think those barriers are false. They're false. Wake up. May we be displayers of God's grace, His glory together. Let me finish with this. One more question, just rehashed. Why wait 3 days? Why wait? Well, there's a lesson to learn. God is great. God is merciful. Why wait 3 days? There was a soul to save. The people, the land of Jericho, would not fully come under God's judgment. The people would not fully understand the rest that they had been promised for over 700 years. I mean, over 700 years. We're ready, God. We're ready. Let's go. No, 3 more days. Why? I think it goes to what Peter said in 2 Peter. You can look it up. He said, God's not slow in keeping His promises. Oh, God's not slow, but He's patient. He's patient. And He would that no one perish. And you know what? That one, that family, God was willing to hold all the people back to say, we got to wait for this one. We got to wait for this one. That's the kind of God that we're talking about that calls for our allegiance. Are you that person that maybe He's holding back heaven for everybody else? To say, I want you to be a part of it too. I want you to know me too. Will you respond? You've heard. Oh, you say you believe. Lord Jesus, I want to take refuge in me. Forgive me. Take my life. Or maybe that person is one of your parents, your child or your neighbor or a family member. That God is saying, or maybe it's somebody that you don't even like, that He wants you to welcome in to say, I'm waiting. And I'm waiting for you, for this person too. Father, we love You. And God, we believe. We believe You. We believe in You. God, help our unbelief. God, wake us up. Wake us up to Your greatness, Your mercy, Your majesty. Father, we're going to leave here. And some will talk about a boring sermon. Some will talk about how we were awakened. We'll talk about a lot of different things. But Lord, what matters is that we know Christ, Your Son. That we live Christ. That we go away from here proclaiming the gospel to ourselves and to all those about us. Seeing what You want to continue to do with us. Oh, Father, give strength and courage to that person this morning that's finally been awakened this morning to say, I'm that person. I'm that Rahab, but God, I take refuge in You. Jesus, I believe. Help us too, Father, because we know almost all of us are also that person that You've put one more person in our path, or You want to put one more person in our path, that we're to proclaim the gospel with our lives, with our words.